Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Ron McLaren, Operations Manager, Sophia, International Top Authority in Skills and Capability Management. Ron, you have this amazing background, and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Good morning, Stephen. Good to talk to you.
Now, Ron, can you profile your history prior to your current role and provide some defining, usable lessons that you wish to share from each of the major events and roles in your history?
Okay, yes, I'd be happy to do that. It goes back quite a long way. I joined the computer industry in 1966 after leaving university, where I did not incidentally discover study computer science. In fact, I had no idea what computer science was, if anybody suggested it to me. And I started off life at the very technical end of computing as somebody writing software and indeed giving training to others in software. And things were very different then, and it seemed to me that in order to teach that kind of stuff in those days, you needed to understand how the computer worked, which of course isn't really true today. But I think, what did I learn then? I probably learned that it's quite important to try and remember what it's like to know nothing about something. And if you can remember that, it helps you a lot when you're trying to explain it to people. You do come across explanations of things in everyday life, which are actually only any use to somebody who already knows the answer. So obviously that's something to be avoided. I also tended to think of programming as a communications experience because it always seemed to me that I was writing something that communicated with the next guy who was going to have to pick up this program and look after it. And I was keen that he should understand how it worked. So anyway, I think that's probably the thing that sticks in my mind about that particular time, apart from all the stuff about learning about lots of new amazing technological thing. This led on after a few years to being involved in a very significant development of computer mainframes. Mainframes, of course, being the only thing we had in those days. And although I was in many areas relatively experienced in this, I think the main thing that I came to realize is that if you are dealing with some people who are quite experienced in an area like that, but who don't have wider experience, the wider experience you have really must be used, and you have a duty to make sure it is used. So that, for example, I was involved in defining program development tools, and the people who are going to develop these tools didn't really have a lot of experience with our clients and what they did with the software and the computers. So it was really important, I realized, to make them listen to what I had to say about what tools were really needed. And I must say that made a difference and gave me a little confidence, because originally I was probably a little apprehensive about dealing with some of these guys with their huge experience. But anyway, that is something which stood me in good stead, because I learned that simple factual knowledge isn't really the whole story. You really have to have some close-up experience giving you insight into these things. Then you understand what that knowledge really means. So you can use it a lot better. So that was a really interesting time for me. And we really went on from there, and I was involved in the later stages of development and introduction of these systems and some of the subsequent releases and upgrades that followed on from them. And that was quite a rewarding experience to see the thing come alive and then start working in the marketplace. But I moved very strongly there towards application software. We were fairly product orientated company, and I was what was known as a product manager, which meant that I was responsible for a certain number of products, now including the marketing of them, not just the development, although of course many of these things were not developed in-house because we were making deals with other organizations to bring their software onto our hardware, which was very strongly the name of the game in those days. I think that probably the most interesting thing about that was that I really had to think quite seriously about the contractual side of these relationships. And I learned quite a bit about contracts and the kind of things which you should and should not do in a contract, even relatively simple things which could get you into trouble if you weren't too careful. But it certainly added a dimension to my understanding of the software business, which I think I'd previously seen as something rather functional, and I now saw it in a much more commercial light, which was probably quite an important stage for me in my development. I think the other thing I learned then was that information about what products are going to be successful in the marketplace is something you really do have to figure out for yourself. Because I know that I've seen people using forecasts from organizations, quite reputable organizations, who are giving forecasts of the uptake of Unix boxes or PCs or LANs or whatever technology you happen to be talking about, and they give forecasts of the gross sales over a number of years. And you really cannot use that as the basis for a marketing plan for a product. You have to know very specifically why people are going to buy your product and why they want to buy that sort of product from you. And so this kind of marketing orientation to one's thinking about the whole business was really quite key to me. And it did provoke me to go off to a UK-based organization called the Chartered Institute of Marketing to do an intensive course and then sit for a diploma, which I achieved in marketing. And I think that's been continually helpful to me. It's interesting, just to leap forward slightly, that in those days one was taught to think quite clearly and specifically about what somebody was going to do with the product. And I find this is very helpful now, because even if one's simply producing some information about a skills framework, you've got to sit down and think, who exactly is going to use this and what exactly are they doing? So you have to have a use cases kind of thinking. I'm sure your audience will know what I mean by that. And that, again, is helpful. And I even found that the kind of requirements that we used to have in those days, or the framework for thinking about requirements, works just as well if you're thinking about something which is not an IT product, simply a bunch of information. So that was good. The world was very different then. I guess the world by then had become fairly Unix orientated. We were at that phase in between mainframes and Microsoft, if you like, where Unix was a very strongly growing thing. So this carried on for a few years, and I must say probably the most interesting thing of all was right towards the end of that period when I was involved in systems management software, which is something I had not previously known anything about, and indeed neither had anybody else, because it was a brand new concept that you actually have software that helped you run and manage the running of IT services. And that again opened up a whole new world for me, because I had not had much experience in service management before that. And it was quite a struggle to begin to understand some of the concepts, but also it was quite a struggle to brush aside some of the nonsense that arises if you have a bunch of technical people who are producing something without a strong marketing raison d'etre. There's quite a lot of discussion and debate to be had before you can get things on the right track and get people focused on something which is actually going to be useful in the marketplace. So that was quite an improving time for me, I think, about how to influence people who didn't really want to be influenced. I think that this probably brought me to the end of my involvement in products, because at that time the company I worked for, which was then known as ICL, although it had been a wholly owned subsidiary of Fujitsu for some time, or at least Fujitsu had been a major shareholder, this company had recognized that its future really lay in providing services, because the service part of the business had been growing, and it was also becoming important, apparent that there was absolutely no use releasing products unless they were going to get a really significant share of the world market. And so we started heading towards being a service company, and we took the interesting step of setting up what was effectively a pilot for the way the business ran thereafter. We called it the Solution Center. I remember we set it up the first day we set it up, there were about six managers, but within a few weeks there were several hundred people working there. We gathered together the people who really understood systems integration. And we introduced a flexible working approach, so that people might be working on almost any project that we were doing. We didn't compartmentalize the people and say you can only work on this sort of project or that, which of course is the way large companies did tend to be organized. So we wanted to get away from that. And so we were a really important model for the future. And I had a lot of involvement in the business of deciding who worked on which project next, than on developing the skills of the people there. And this really was quite an interesting time, because it became apparent that we needed something which defined the capability of the people, which of course our traditional approach with job descriptions didn't do. All job descriptions do is tell you about the job, and if you're thinking about some job which they're not doing yet and how to find a person that fits that job, you don't necessarily have the information at your fingertips. Okay, with a small organization, you possibly know the people and you can make that decision, but we were clearly trying to do something that was going to work for the whole company, and a completely different approach was needed. And so that is really how I came to be involved subsequently in setting up one of the professional communities that were set up in our company then. We had a very inspirational HR director who saw the future pretty clearly and realized that we needed a company-wide flexible resourcing system. He also realized that we needed to heighten the idea of professionalism in the company. And so it was decided that every person in the company would be in a professional community, whether it was marketing or HR or finance or what have you. And in fact, the largest one, of course, being an IT company, was the technical professional community, which we called engineering. And I was given the job of setting up and running that. And so that's really when I had to focus for the first time on this concept of roles and what are the roles in IT. And we probably had about 19 of them, I seem to recollect, at the beginning. Some of them there for sort of transitional reasons, but reducing to about 16 after probably 12 to 18 months. And what those 16 roles did was simply define the categories of IT professional which you would recognize anywhere. Things like service manager, service technician, software engineer, software development manager, architect, and so on. And when you take that broad look, you really shouldn't be any more than about 16. Bear in mind that I was responsible mainly for the technical end of the community, so not business analysts, for example. I found this approach worked very well because, first of all, it meant that the company recognized essentially what people were, rather than simply knowing what job they were doing at the moment. So that was a big step forward. But the main thing was that we effectively then had an asset register. We knew how many people we'd got in each of these categories. We knew what it took to build large systems. And so based on our forecasts of the business, we roughly knew what resourcing we were going to need into the future. So that meant the whole business of resource planning became a lot simpler, really a lot more rational. And so that was about the control of the whole process. But it also meant that since we'd recorded what people's capabilities were, we found it much easier to find the right people for projects. And this is what I found to be absolutely key about this. The way the organization worked was that when somebody was assigned to a project, there were essentially two voices making the decision. One was the voice of the person saying, "I need that guy for my project." But the other was the voice of the person who was responsible for that guy as a resource, who was quite capable of saying, "Well, no, you can't have that person because it's just inappropriate for that person to work again on a project like this. It needs to do something different." So you have to build into that process the ability to think, what is the right project for this person, not just what is the right person for this project. Because it turns out this single act of deciding what project somebody is going to work on is the single most important thing you can do about that person's development. I strongly believe that about 80% of what people know and what they're capable of, they've learned by accretion. In other words, by gradual addition to what they knew before. And all that is really takes place in the workplace. Of course, every now and then, it's something where you need to send somebody on a course because the thing that they need to acquire is just too chunky to be learned by what I call J-learning, on-the-job learning. And I think this was quite crucial. And so there was a lot of interesting things learned then about flexible resourcing and people management. But it struck me was that the most important one was learning that it is actually all about putting people to work. That is, after all, why you hired them in the first place. Well, by this time I was getting pretty near retiring, and I had been dealing with some external bodies that are active in information technology. And so when I indicated to one of them that I was retiring, I was asked to take responsibility for this new thing, this skills framework for the information age. And I did that. I was really just exactly what I was looking for. And that was about 10 years ago. And we had no idea, of course, how popular Sophia would become. And it's now used all around the world. So that's really been a very encouraging and rewarding experience. And I guess it brings me about up to date.
So, Ron, you know, you talked about now becoming part of the Sophia Foundation. Can you then profile further your current role and your measurable goals?
Okay. The current role, I need to describe to you how the foundation works. The basic idea of the foundation is that it remains as small as possible, consumes as little resources as possible, and tries to work through other organizations. So there are five members who we would think of as owners of the foundation if it were a company with share capital, but there are no shares, and the owners are not allowed to take any dividends or any money out of it. And they are, in general, professional bodies. And each of those five organizations provides a director. Of course, they all have a day job working for their own organization, so their work for the foundation is part-time. And they're really like a board of trustees. I am the main employee, not the only one, but we are really very small. And I really do everything which is operational, like signing up partners, because this is possibly one of the most important things we do. We decided the business model would be that the framework would be promoted by the activities of our business partners. And these typically are consultancies, training organizations, other professional bodies, all of whom will find it useful to support their business operations, to use Sophia, and this thereby promotes the take-up of Sophia in wherever they happen to be working. So that is where most of our work takes place. It takes place in the offices of our partners, and we act as a steering influence, and probably the most important thing we do, apart from actually signing up those partners, is to produce an update of Sophia. This is an interesting exercise because really there aren't any new skills in IT, but nevertheless there are new perspectives on old skills, and we need to do an update every few years to make sure that things stay relevant. So there you can see an organization which is trying to cause a lot of things to happen, but not doing too many of them itself. And indeed, most of the work which is directly under our control is also outsourced. I mean, the translations, of course, are outsourced. The work on our website, well, as you can expect, in this day and age, many things are outsourced. And we're probably quite a good example of a very small organization that gets quite a lot done, and most of it being done by other people. So that is, in a nutshell, how the organization works and my responsibilities for overseeing that kind of activity. Now, you say, what are our measurable goals? Measurable is an interesting word because it's something we do have an interesting time with. Our goal, essentially, is that Sophia is the recognized way of describing IT skills throughout the IT industry. Now, you might say, well, how do you know when you've got there? Is everybody using it, or 75%, or 50%, or what? And to be frank with you, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I know that we've made huge strides, and but there's still a long way to go. Sophia is used in over 100 countries, and that's in itself is very encouraging. Of course, one of the consequences of the way we work is that we don't have strong and direct relationships with individual users. First of all, because there are too many of them, and secondly, because when they've downloaded something from our website, it'd be very difficult for us to keep up to date on exactly how they were using it or what they were doing it with. So we have goals, A, to stay relevant, and B, to spread the word further around the industry. And the rate at which new partners sign up, new consultants become accredited, providers of qualifications to say they'd like to map Sophia to their qualifications, the rate at which that happens gives us a good idea that we're in a very healthy situation and moving forward. That's probably the best answer I can give to your question.
And also, if we can further explore, sort of, what are the origins of Sophia?
Well, this goes back to some time in the late 90s, where a number of governments were getting concerned about where are the information technology skills coming from. Are we going to have enough IT skills to support the growth of the economy, or is the IT sector going to be weak? companies can't exploit IT, that kind of thing. And so a number of actions were taken by governments. I have to say I have a fairly sceptical view about the kind of things that governments do in these situations. I feel they have to do something, and probably one or two of those things turn out to be useful. But one of the things that happened was that a man called Stevens was commissioned to write a report for the UK government on this specific subject. And he came to the conclusion that it really would be very helpful if we all knew what each other were talking about when we talked about IT skills, because people meant different things by the same expression. And there was no common understanding of what the skills were. And people confused knowledge with skill. People confused general areas of activity with skill. And frankly, it was all a bit of a mess. So the Stevens report was very well received, and the government gave out the message to certain organisations in the UK that it really would be helpful if they got on and stimulated the production of such a thing. And so this work was led by an organisation in the UK called eSkills UK, which is responsible for doing things to stimulate the health of the use of technology, specifically information technology. And they project managed a quite serious operation to involve people from industry, that is from large corporations using IT, and particularly from IT companies, which in fact turned out to be crucial. And the operation was simply to figure out what is a good way of defining all these skills in IT. Of course, at the beginning, it lurched from one way to another. First of all, there was too much detail, and people thought, oh, this is too complicated. And then they simplified it, and people said, oh, there's not enough information here. Not very satisfying at all. So then we went back to putting more information in. And in the end, the thing was just about right. But I said that the involvement of the IT company was crucial. And I think the reason for this is because it was the IT companies that had traditionally thought seriously about the skills of their people, because their IT people were their business, of course. Whereas in other organizations, you find a totally different situation. For example, I remember going to visit a very large bank whose name is known around the world, and to find that they were cramming their IT people into roles and levels which were used to define levels of banking. So I thought, you know, you can't pretend that your software engineer is a junior banker. That doesn't work. But the IT companies typically have made great strides in this. I know we had, I know IBM had, and it's true of the others. And therefore, they were a very strong source of objective thinking about skills. But of course, we had to produce something that worked for everybody, and the input that we had from the other organizations was probably more voluminous. But it wasn't too difficult over a period of probably about a year to shake this down into some sort of sensible framework. And we realized that we did need to say what the skills were, and for each skill we needed to say something about the levels, and that immediately gave us two dimensions. And we decided that it would be a big mistake to try and go beyond two dimensions. I've seen diagrams of things like this which talk about three dimensions, or even try to imagine four. And, you know, if you're writing a program, it's very easy to handle arrays of several dimensions. But when you're presenting information to people, which they're going to use in a nice practical day-to-day context, that kind of approach doesn't work. So we kept it as simple as we could. And so we then set up the Sophia Foundation so that we had the right kind of bodies involved to look after this thing. And we went off from there. So really, that's the history of the origins of it.
You know, just an interesting, remarkable history in terms of Sophia. So where is Sophia heading?
I think probably the main thing for us is about interconnection and relationships, because we still have the aim of spreading the use of Sophia. But I think at the back of my mind, I always think to myself, you know, this is a marketing operation, although the thing is free for most people. And markets are funny things. Sometimes things change and all of a sudden people don't want this anymore. Now, usually it's because they want something else. And at the moment, I don't see something else coming that would make people go off this. I think IT skills will always be useful. They'll always be essential, in fact. And knowing what they are is never going to be a bad thing. So long as we think of Sophia as a useful resource, then I think that's fine. But one of the key ways in which fear can be made more relevant to people is by relating it to the other things which they use. For example, in recent years, we've seen considerable growth of interest in universities. And one of the reasons is that universities want to do two things. First of all, they want to reassure potential students that their education will be relevant and will help them get a job, and therefore showing how the education relates to the skills defined by Sophia has become interesting, and universities are doing that, and several of them have done this. And the other thing is that, of course, universities are also interested in mature students, people going back from work to do a master's degree or something like this. And the universities have been using Sophia as a way of communicating with employers and saying, well, if somebody comes and does this master's degree, they will get much more depth in areas that support these Sophia skills. And people have found this interesting. And I know this has happened in one very interesting organization, which is called the Open University, where the people generally work from home. But it's happening in more traditional universities as well, as far away as Chile, where a nationwide university called INACAP is using Sophia in this way, and others are starting to do the same thing. So that kind of relationship, I think, is important. And the other sort of connection, of course, is with qualifications. There's an organization called what I call ISACA, and I think you may pronounce ISACA, which is to do with qualifications, many of them to do with security, where those qualifications have a relationship with Sophia Skills, which has been displayed on their website and with ours. We also have this arrangement with CompTIA, which I guess everybody's familiar with. And so that kind of development, it seems to me, is important. I don't see a goal, I don't see a shining light in the future saying, when we've got there, we've done it. I can only see a journey. I know that sounds like a cliche, but I really can only see a journey. And I probably can't see much further than the next bend in the road.
You know, it's interesting that you mention ISACA and CompTIA, because those are such well-known organizations. And, you know, ISACA is the world's largest, I guess, auditing security governance organization, well-known for COVID-5. And, of course, CompTIA has, I guess, an array or a consortium of well over 1,000 organizations now, and they have an array of certifications. And for them to map to Sophia indicates significant third-party validation of the framework that has been produced. So, you know, those are good signs.
Yes, they are. We're very pleased.
Now, how would you compare Sophia with other frameworks?
I think the other frameworks that I've seen have a particular slant to them. For example, there have been other frameworks in other countries where they have been either produced in a particular industry or perhaps according to some particular government conception of how things should look. And I don't really see any other framework of skills which simply sets out in a very neutral kind of way to describe what are the skills in IT. If you make the boundaries of the question a bit wider and say, well, we're not just talking about skills frameworks, then of course you're into all sorts of things like the IT infrastructure library, for example, where of course there's a huge amount of information really to enable people to adopt best practice in doing things. So I would say the main thing about Sophia is that it's a simple, recognizable description of things that people need to know about. And I wonder maybe if it would be reasonable not to call it a framework, although we do, and simply say, well, it's a bunch of definitions of skills. I think frameworks often are orientated towards showing people how to do things. You get frameworks of careers which show people how to move through their career. And, you know, if you're in this role at the moment, then you have the opportunity of doing this or that in the future according to which particular aptitudes you have. And I think, in general, the frameworks that I have come across over the years have been guides to the way you do things. Whereas Sophia doesn't attempt to be a guide to show you how to do things, because by doing that, it immediately makes itself irrelevant to people who don't want to do things that way. And so we've taken the view it is simply a resource. It's simply a bunch of information. whatever you approach you take to managing your people, this resource is surely going to be useful. And so we determined that it should remain a component.
There's different stakeholders out there, and it's important for frameworks to be of value to these different stakeholders. So what is the value of Sophia to employers?
Well, I think that I perhaps can answer that by looking back into my own history. When I set up the engineering professional community in ICL Fujitsu, I probably spent the most part of a year defining things. What are the roles? What are the capabilities in all of these roles? Going around the company, agreeing this with the management of the various parts of the company, making sure it made sense for the practitioners who were going to be in those roles, and testing things out and make sure it would actually work. What I basically did was to write the definition of what was expected of somebody in that role from my experience, blending it together with all the consultations I'd had with other people. Bear in mind that I'd done most of these roles myself, or managed people who were in them, so it wasn't as if I was starting with a blank sheet of paper. I had subsequently thought about this and thought, if I had had Sophia available at that stage, of course it wasn't, it probably would have saved me 5 or 6 months in doing that. But more than that, it would have given me a lot of confidence that these are accepted ideas around the industry, and it might have been possible to spend somewhat less time worrying about the details and was it going to work. But certainly it would have saved a lot of time. And because of the way Sophia is defined, I think it would have introduced a lot of objectivity, because there's two things I think that Sophia really do for people. First of all, it gives you consistency, so that you know that people around the organization, if they talk about a particular skill, they all mean the same thing. And the other thing is it introduces more objectivity. So there's not too much doubt about what is the difference between this skill at level 3 and this skill at level 4. And this works in various ways. It means we can have more confidence when we talk about our skilled assets. So if we say we've got 347 software developers at this level, we know that pretty much they are at that level. You know, there's no doubt about that, and we can rely on that. But it also means for the individual, which is also very important, individuals have interviews with their managers to talk about their achievements, how they're getting on, and what that means when interpreting the future. And what you really want to get away from is the kind of complaints you might have heard traditionally with, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm a senior software engineer, but my boss only thinks I'm an ordinary software engineer, and you know, I don't really get it. So this kind of objectivity helps you to focus on exactly what it is that you should be able to do that you're not doing at the moment. And that really makes for a much calmer situation in the management of people and allows folks to focus on the future and what they really need to do to develop themselves. So I think these are the kind of things that you get. And it's very difficult to just extract those things from the overall mix and say, okay, that's worth $30,000 or whatever it is. One area where you can translate into money, though, however, is that if you have a proper definition of people and their capabilities and it is objective and you can rely on it in order to find people for projects, then you should find that you spend less money on hiring in external contractors and freelancers. We certainly found that this was the case, because there'd be an inclination to hire a contractor for a particular piece of work, because you didn't know that actually we've got some people at some place in the organization who could do that, and they're not very busy at the moment. Until you've A, introduced a proper flexible working model, and B, got some really objective definition of what the people are capable of, then you can't do that. So that's an area where you could normally put some real money on what you've saved.
Ultimately, you have, I guess, and the figures vary. It's interesting. When I talked to CompTIA, I think they said there's something like 35 million IT professionals, and this is growing 30% yearly for the next 5 years. And then I talked to David Foote, and he's indicating that even in the U.S., there's probably something like 24 million IT professionals, and many of them aren't even counted in some way. So there's a big sea out there of people working in the field. And I guess that begs the question, what is the value of Sophia to IT professionals?
I think the value for IT professionals is probably twofold. First of all, purely looking at self-development and self-interest, people can look at these definitions and they're categorized so that you can see fairly quickly which ones might be relevant to you given your current career and direction. And you can look at those and understand what people are going to expect of you and what things you ought to be able to do. And I think it is really important that people exercise some sort of influence over their own development and know that the developments are right and the right sort of things. It is easy to get carried away with the technology. And I think there was a period a few years ago, probably when we came out of mainframes, maybe when we came out of Unix, I don't know, where suddenly it seemed that a lot of people picked up some technical knowledge, whether it was about a programming language or a database or an operating system or whatever. Lots of people knowing these things, lots of people working with that knowledge and possibly not working as well as they might have done because they didn't have the essential, what I would call engineering disciplines, or if you like, the actual underlying professional skills that would enable them to deploy their technical knowledge in a responsible, creative, consistent way with real, you know, technical integrity, let's call it that. And so I think the idea that there is a resource there that will help you build that kind of thing into your own development is important, and it should be important to every professional. The other thing which is important is that Sophia gives the possibility of giving you a much more stable or, shall we say, agreed relationship with your employer as to what it is you're capable of or not and which are the kind of things that you ought to learn next. So I think it's really a breath of fresh air because it simply reveals the truth about situations as to what you can and what you can't do. And I would have thought that would be a good thing for most people. I suppose I ought to say that this kind of knowledge helps people develop their careers. I'm slightly nervous about saying that, because it's not obvious to me that more than about 5% of people do actually plan their careers. And I think the rest of us take opportunities as they arise. We decide to make changes in direction for reasons that might not have been apparent to us 5 or 10 years ago. So I don't know about career development, but I know certainly short-term development of what's my next job, what's the job after, is certainly facilitated by understanding what it is you need to be capable of. And I think that is very helpful. It can even be helpful in what you might call a negative way. If somebody thinks they might be suited to adopting some kind of role in IT, you can look at the skills that are required and decide, well, do I really think that's me? Am I really likely to develop those skills? So I think it helps people keep on track, really. And that's probably, I would think that kind of summarizes how the individual would look at it.
You know, there's this whole concept of skills that's sort of the foundation of Sophia and other frameworks. And so maybe we should just get to the heart of it. What is skills development?
Skills development for me, from an employer's perspective, is having the right skilled people in the right place at the right time. So we need to do this work. It's important for the business and we have the people so we can do it. Of course, if you're going to outsource the work, you need to know that whoever is going to do the work has those skills. We're seeing Sophia used in outsourcing situations. We're seeing governments expecting to see skills defined in that sort of way in outsourcing environments. But it seems to me it is about running the business. It's about having the wherewithal to do the work, having the right skills in the right place at the right time. I mentioned before that it seems to me this revolves completely around deploying people and actually putting people to work. And I think it's possibly not very healthy for people to think of themselves as primarily involved in skills development. I mean, that might literally be true, but in order for you to understand the point of it and get the thing properly contextualized, you need to think about it in terms of people working, people being put to work. So now you might have a follow-up, but I think that's probably my answer to your question.
You have used the phrase, kill the complexity dragon. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. I spent a fair amount of time giving training courses for people who were going to use Sophia. And generally what I would suggest to them was that they were going to build some approach to managing their people inside their own organizations, and that Sophia would be a component of it. And it always struck me that some of these people came from HR and some of them came from the technical background. And that always struck me as being a tendency in IT, people who've been in a technical background, to provide too much information, to provide a lot of information, and maybe to introduce some complex structures into that information. And these always, from the information provider's point of view, seem tremendously positive. I've given you all this information, I've arranged it so you can see all these relationships and interrelationships and so on. And what they've actually done is make it much more difficult to digest and much more difficult to use. And I just believe this is a tendency that those of us who have a technical background have. And it is important to control it, of course, and some people are very good at doing that. So really killing the complexity dragon was just my way of reminding people, we had this expression, keep it simple, stupid. And so you need to keep, if you're producing a bunch of information for internal use inside an organization, this is how we're going to manage our folks, this is how we're going to appraise them, this is going to how we're assess them and so on, then you need to make sure it's really simple and digestible by all the people who are going to use it. And you need to resist that temptation to make it more complicated. I just could give you perhaps two examples of that. One of them slightly negative, I'm afraid to say. During the very early days of my work with professional profiles, the profiles, of course, as well as containing professional skills, knowledge, that kind of thing, would also contain some information about what kind of behavioral competencies somebody in a particular role ought to have. Now, I was conscious of the fact that a lot of management is not all that comfortable with behavioral competencies, or certainly wasn't in those days. So I made a little chart as part of the role profile to relate the behavioral competencies to some aspects of the work so that people could see why perhaps communication skills were important in such a role, whereas they might not have thought that. Well, this was okay. I was probably guilty myself of making things too complicated. But one day I discovered that somebody had turned this little chart into a spreadsheet, and he'd put weightings against the various things. And when he appraised his people, he put numbers in all the boxes, and lo and behold, a number would pop out at the bottom right-hand corner, you know, saying 42 or something, meaning you're not very good. And I thought, this is absolutely obscene. The guy has completely thrown off his responsibility for making decisions and judgments. And so I immediately removed all those things from the professional profiles and never made a mistake like that again. So I thought both he and I in different ways were guilty of wallowing in information rather than thinking about the key issues. The other thing I would say is that organizations are typically going to produce some kind of description of what it means to be a software engineer. I think if you're going to work in a flexible resourcing environment, it's quite important you do that kind of thing. So you have a document that says, this is what we expect of our software engineers. Never mind what job you're doing at the moment. Whatever job you're doing, you know, you need to deliver this kind of functionality. So that's quite good, but you need to keep these things short and sweet, and don't try to cover all the bases and draw the entire boundary. You just need to capture the essence of it. And it did strike me that instead of doing that, certainly in the beginning, a lot of people would be better off if they simply listed the names of the roles and say, well, we have software engineers, we have service managers, service technicians, service administrators, software development managers, generic project managers, architects, CIOs, what have you, and not offer any definition at all. Simply by doing that, you achieve a lot of commonality between the way people think about things. And for many organizations, that in itself would be a huge step forward without starting to produce all the supporting information. Of course, you'll soon reach the stage where you want the supporting information. But this is just my way of saying to you that quite a small amount of information is often enough. And it's really quite useful to be able to figure out what that is and not overdo it. I mean, how many websites have you been to which present you with far too much information and you couldn't find out what you wanted to know, though it was probably there somewhere? So I think, you know, there is this dragon in a lot of us which will produce too much information, make it too complex. Well, you have to kill that.
You know, you have the HR department out there, and you also have management. So what about managing the managers?
Yes, I think I was probably fortunate that this idea occurred to me at a fairly early stage. It may be that it's always been obvious to everybody else, but when I started to be involved in how we manage skills and develop people in the workplace, I realized that we weren't in the place that we wanted to be, or we wanted to be in some different place, and that the key to it was not all those people out there who maybe should have had more skills. The difference was how we were managing them, and the difference was going to be created, the move, the change was going to be created by the management. And what I had to do was to focus on a scheme that would actually influence the management, and to do that in two ways. Really, one was, how do we deploy people? How do we decide who's the right person for this work? How do we decide what we think the future holds for this person? You know, will she become an architect one day, or will she just stay as a technician, or maybe it's better she moves into management? And when we do appraisals, are we really objective about it? Do we give managers the right guidance on what we think makes a good appraisal? And do we insist that they produce development plans? Do we take steps to find out that they have produced a development plan? And do we even then, and this really would be nirvana, make sure that all those development plans actually get carried out? So it really struck me at an early stage, that if you produce some kind of framework or way of working in an organization, it really has got to focus on altering the behavior of your management, because they're the ones who are going to influence what happens to all the people. And it is a management exercise. And for that reason, I've really tended to see this, I suppose, from the employer's point of view, although being an employee myself, of course, that aspect is never far away. But I do think that when you're putting something in like this, I mentioned to you earlier on the idea of requirements being something which is important, not just when you're producing IT products, where we, of course, think a great deal about requirements, but in a situation like this, when you're producing something which is simply a bunch of information. And during the product phase of my life, I learnt that there were a number of perspectives from which you could see a requirement. One is the enterprise manager, you know, what do I need for the organization? And then you have the end user, which person is actually going to use this stuff and sit down at his or her desk and do something with it. So there you have the end user who has certain requirements that the thing should actually, this should help me do my job, and it should be easy to use. And you have the service manager, the person who's actually going to provide some operational service in the company based on that information. So without taking it any further than those three perspectives, you can see the first two are pretty apparent. The enterprise manager saying, why should I have some investment in a new way of managing my people? What's it going to do for me? The second thing is, well, the people who are actually going to be using this information, are they going to find it actually helps them manage their IT staff? And of course, there is service provider, and I think in this case you'd say the service provider is HR, because they're the ones who are going to be providing this new way of doing things. And so those same perspectives apply when you're producing something like that, as they do if you are producing an IT system. And I think that's a really, you know, that kind of discipline, way of looking at things, is pretty key. And again, it's an aspect of managing the management, really.
You know, I've done about 10 conferences this year, including the Economic Forum in Europe, and what I see across all of these conferences is that there are emerging technologies such as big data, mobile computing, social media, cloud computing, this whole concept of consumerization of IT, bring your own device, security, and so on. So what are companies doing to address these areas from a skills and competency perspective?
I think probably the big difference that it makes is that now there are people who need certain skills, and which they didn't need before. The skills move around. I mean, if you look at these things, we talk about these as new technologies. Most of them are not really new technologies. They're old technologies appearing in a new form. So certain technologies are now in your hand, whereas they used to be sitting on your desk. Certain technologies used to be down in the bottom floor of your building, and now they're somewhere away in a cloud. And probably most of this isn't genuine new technology, although, of course, I've been in IT long enough to know that when you have something like this, you're sure as heck going to present it to the public as something new and exciting. This is only human nature. But I think, therefore, that what people have to do is to reevaluate the roles. I mean, certainly there's a big commercial change in many situations where people were doing things internally which they're now going to buy, because a lot of these technologies, like the cloud situation, for example, probably involves more outsourcing. There's not many people are going to set up their own clouds, are there? And so you'll find that there is more procurement, there are greater need for the procurement people to understand what's going on, but also the people who are responsible for receiving these services into the company need to be able to evaluate them, and they probably need to have some skills which they didn't have before. And I think they're not skills that didn't exist, but they probably just moved around inside the organization. And I would guess that is one of the main things. But there is another area too, which it strikes me as significant, which is that where is the boundary between IT and IT users? And I think this is an interesting question, particularly for us in the Sophia Foundation, because if you think about somebody who 20 years ago would have been using a word processor to prepare some information, maybe some quite seriously large information with a really well thought out structure to it, it would eventually be printed and put on paper. Well, that person now would be developing a website and putting the information in there. Okay, somebody else might be developing the website and the content management system, and our author might simply be putting the information in. But actually we find the line has been blurred, and therefore some of the things which we thought of as traditional IT activities, you would now put down on the list of the kind of capabilities that an IT user should have. You know, yesterday I could use a word processor, today I can set up a website. So it always seemed to me that it's almost like archaeology. We're sitting on a lot of layers of stuff. Right down there at the bottom is the computer. And on top of it, all sorts of layers of software have been built up over the years. And we're sitting on top of this pile. And as a result of that, even simple users can now do quite exciting things that would have been inconceivable 50 years ago, unless you started writing an assembler or COBOL program. And I think that continues. So as well as the apparent new technologies, it's this business of some technologies getting themselves into user product and things used by users, and thereby increasing the potential for users to do things themselves. And so usually this stuff is so well packaged that the users don't really need those technical skills with any degree of intensity. But I do believe there is some tendency to move in that direction. And certainly when doing updates of Sophia, we give some consideration to these areas and say, well, you know, is this something we should be building into the framework? Is this a user skill or is it an IT skill? We try to be fairly strict about that, because in the end we could end up trying to define the skills for all aspects of industry, which would be a foolish mistake. But I'm sure you see what I mean. I think that's possibly as significant, maybe not quite as obvious as the business about the new technologies that you referred to.
There's an organization, the International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, which was founded at the behest of the United Nations. I guess they held their first World Congress in 1959. And they're a UN-founded organization. They're an official UN consultative body. They're sector member for ICT to the ITU. And this year, they held their 2012 World Congress, which I mentioned is held every 2 years. And you were there, and you presented. And I know it was quite an amazing presentation. There was a good take-up from the audience in regards to some of the things you heard and said and presented at that Congress. So, Ron, from this IFIP World Congress, do you have any added valuable insights that you gained or that you provided as a speaker and leader at this event?
I think, well, I should first of all caution that I was at the conference, unfortunately, only for one day, which was the day, of course, in which I was speaking. So I have a kind of narrow view of it. But I certainly felt But judging by the number of people that attended that stream, that it was very popular compared with the total number of people apparently attending the conference. And I thought that was very welcoming, because to have that kind of recognition of the importance of the skills side of the business is, you know, always encouraging. The thing that struck me mostly, as a matter of fact, was one particular presentation, which was on the subject of online learning. And I remember when online learning started to raise its head above the parapet, its star became very bright, but then it seemed to fade, and people started to seem to think, well, maybe this isn't quite as exciting as we thought it was. And possibly that's because a lot of traditional learning approaches have been moved to an online scenario. But it was quite apparent, listening to the presentation, that this has really moved into a new generation. And online learning systems now are being produced by people who really understand how online learning systems should work. And I was quite intrigued to know that some universities are now using these kind of products, and that it was probably going to make quite an impact. I just had a conversation with a colleague of mine who works in a university, and there's no doubt that they are expecting quite considerable changes to take place here, not just in their ability to use these things to provide learning services, but of course to raise into the whole question, well, do you need to go to university to be a university? Which is not a new idea, but that is something which could spread. And I think this would have quite an impact in the industry, not just from the point of view of the providers of the learning, but it seems to me it might well open up possibilities for people who would not otherwise have made use of that kind of learning or benefited from it. But in particular, it might enable people to take more control and have more influence over their futures. I guess a lot of people are in a situation where the extent to which they learn is conditioned by their employer. So you might want to learn about some aspect of IT, and it might or might not suit your employer for you to do that. But if you are able to take advantage of these facilities yourself, in a way that really worked, then this would be probably quite beneficial. So I would imagine that is going to be quite significant. I suppose if I'm allowed to say something which is less than encouraging, I think we saw a certain amount of hand-wringing about, oh dear, we haven't got enough IT resources, and where are they all going to come from? We've heard some of that stuff before, and generally the people who say it are not actually going to influence the situation by very much. There you are, you hear a cynic talking there. But I think that there is an encouraging sign that people are really concerned about how professional the IT business is. And I think that this is one of the other things which came up very strongly in that conference, and I've certainly heard it in other scenarios. In fact, I've heard it over quite an extended period of years in other scenarios. And I think that during our time in this industry, probably if we make it our goal to move things forward a bit, you know, it's like one of those situations where I can't see any further than the next bend. I don't see how we turn IT into a kind of regulated profession like accountancy or law or something like that. But I do think we can move it forward, and I do think we can encourage people to make sure that people are properly qualified, and that they behave and their qualifications are not simply those about technical knowledge, but are such that require people to behave with professionalism and integrity. So, I mean, those are, without rambling on forever, Stephen, I think they're the things that particularly struck me about that conference. Of course, apart from the fact that Amsterdam is a beautiful city.
It's interesting that you mentioned the presentation on online learning and this whole concept of massively open online courses or MOOCs that are kind of, you know, shaping the planet in many ways. And that was Carrie Linkletter's session, which I also found quite intriguing as well. So it's amazing what's occurring today. Now, I have this next question. You know, we have computing. It's been out there 50, 60 years now, perhaps a little bit longer. And then we have other professions like medicine, law, engineering. in accounting where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials. Do you feel that computing should be on par with these other professions?
I'm always worried about saying that something should or shouldn't be. I think it would be positive if that were the case, and I think it will take some time to get there. One of the reasons I think this is because a line of thought was provoked by somebody, I think it was at this conference we were talking about in Amsterdam. Somebody said or pointed out that it had taken the lawyers, the best part of 1,000 years to get to the stage where they were a professionally regulated body, or maybe it was only 500. Our industry is not much more than half a century old. So when are we expecting that to happen? I thought that was an interesting thought, but it made me consider, well, how did it actually come about? Now, of course, some of these things come about because the people who are involved in an industry want to set up some guild to prevent anybody else taking their business, so they make it difficult for other people to enter the field. And that can only happen in a situation where the work is predominantly outsourced. In other words, companies didn't generally do their own lawyering. They went out and hired lawyers to do work for them. And so the legal profession acted as a service. Now, we in IT are by and large working as employees. Everybody is acting as an employee. But of course, we have seen over recent years, last 10 years particularly, the increase in outsourcing, so that folks are no longer doing work for themselves. They're paying an organization to do it for them. And I think we have seen signs that some organizations are going to some length to validate the skills and capability of the outsourcer who's providing them with the skills or with the service. In some cases, they have not done that, and they've suffered the consequences. But I do know situations where, for example, I know quite close to me, only about 50 miles north of me, the UK government is regularly asking outsourcers to describe the skills of their people in terms of SOFIA, and I know that there are outsourcers doing this. I know there are outsourcers in India preparing rate cards so that you can see what you've got to pay for which kind of person, and the rate card is indicating what SOFIA skills they have. But it seems to me this is part of a general move to say, well, show me that your people have really got what it takes. And I think that's a move towards that kind of professional environment that you describe. But to say, well, how far are we away from it? How soon do we get there? I find that very difficult to say. Let me tell you something which happened to me round about 1968, because when I joined the computer industry in 66, I joined up with a professional body. And 2 years later, I thought to myself, these guys are not doing very much. I don't think it's helping me at all. And I had a conversation with my boss, and I said, do you think that the day is going to arrive when you'll have to join a professional body or you won't be able to work in computing? And he said, no, it's a crazy idea. He said, there aren't nearly enough people in it. I can't imagine it ever happening. Well, of course, it wasn't a very forward-looking view, but so far he's turned out to be right. But I do believe that we are closer to that now. And the mere fact that there are so many organizations now offering certifications, there is such a demand for this, shows that there is clearly a need amongst users, clearly a desire to have some sort of underwriting of people's capabilities so that we can really believe it. And I think that is all very positive. Of course, it might not end up, the need might not end up being satisfied by a traditional body, you know, like the law, but dealing with IT. It might be some completely different approach. We're used in IT to the idea that we do things in totally new ways, and I think this could be an example of that. I haven't figured out what it is, but since you've asked me the question, I think I might go away and think about this. How do we reassure people of the skills and professionalism and integrity of the folks working in IT? What is the way of solving that problem in the 21st century? I don't know. I hope we do get there, but I don't think I'll be working by the time it happens, so I'll be safe.
Well, it's interesting, you know, at the IFIP World Congress, Malaysia did a presentation, and I guess they're proceeding to officially kind of legislate in some way the IT profession in their country, and this organization called IFIP IP3 will be very supportive of that and advise them and provide help in any way possible. But it's interesting that there is now a country that's proceeding along this path and have started the process. So perhaps Malaysia will leave the way for the rest of the world.
If I can suspend, I'm sure the rest of the world will be watching, because to see somebody actually doing this, you know, everybody will be interested in how are you doing this? Will it work for us? And I think it's good that somebody's doing it.
Now, Ron, from your extensive speaking, travels, and work, you must come across some really interesting stories, and especially because you're really an acknowledged world leader in the profession. You have this amazing success history. So I'd be interested to see if there's something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing that you can share.
I think something which sticks in my mind, because it was so surprising, and of course it has nothing really to do with business, but it did arise out of a business journey. I took a journey to Australia many years ago, and I knew that a guy who'd once shared a flat with me in London when we both worked had subsequently moved to Australia. And it occurred to me that if I phoned a particular person, he might give me the name and address of somebody else, and I could contact them, and they could contact somebody else, and then I could find out the address of this guy's sister, and she could tell me where he was living in Australia. Well, I didn't follow up that route before going on my trip. So I went assuming that we would not meet up. Australia is a big place. But I travelled round all of the capitals in Australia during that time. I must have been in Australia for about a month, but one day I was in Brisbane, standing in the hotel. There was a pop group staying there called ABBA, which were quite new at the time, and I was chatting to the manager about how difficult it was to deal with all the crowds of people who wanted ABBA's photograph, and I suddenly noticed my old pal standing on the other side of the foyer, and he made eye contact, and we immediately went over and shook hands and all the rest of it. And we were amazed at the coincidence, and I said, well, you don't know how much of a coincidence it is, because actually I'm only here in this hotel for one night. And he said, well, it's even more than you think, because actually I live in Melbourne, and I'm only here for one night. So I don't know how you calculate the odds of that, but it seemed to me absolutely astounding. And it's probably one of my most significant non-business memories for all the business trips I've made. I have to say later that on leaving Australia via New Zealand and flying to Houston via Honolulu and Los Angeles, I eventually went to bed that day 36 hours after I'd got up, and I think it was still the 4th of July, which kind of rounded that trip off. But I must say the coincidence of meeting that guy Robin down in Australia after all those years was absolutely amazing. I've had some other interesting experiences as well, but I think that's probably one that sticks in my mind.
It seems to me you related another story to me in the past, something about a driving incident. I don't know if you wanted to share that or not.
Yes, I don't mind. This was when I was visiting a manufacturing plant, development plant, in fact, that we had in Utica in Upper New York State. And over the weekend, I needed to go to Toronto, and I got a hire car. This, I think, was my first visit to the USA. It's a very long time ago. And it was the first time I'd driven in the US. I didn't know much about American motor cars except what I'd seen in films, and the thing which I'd hired didn't seem like anything I'd ever seen in a film. But I was driving up I-9, I think that's the name of the road, and of course you had a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit then, and I wanted to get to Toronto without spending half my life getting there. So I was going fairly quickly, but I was also concerned that the car didn't seem to go any faster than 85, and I couldn't understand why that was, because, you know, a normal saloon car in the UK at that stage would do 120 without much trouble. Not that you were allowed to do that, of course, I hasten to add. Anyway, I'm driving up I-9 doing about 84, wondering why the car wasn't going any faster, and suddenly there's a siren wailing in the window, and the policeman pulls me over. Well, he wants my driver's license, which is somewhere in the trunk, so I rummage around and find it, and he's never seen one like this before. England, what state is this? New England? I said, no, is it Old England? Oh, I see, he says. It's pretty disappointed, I can tell. And we have a bit of a conversation about it, and I apologize that it really got away from me going down that hill. And, you know, it's the first time I've been in the US, and I'm already used to your speed limits. You've probably heard all these excuses before. But in the end, he said, well, where are you going? And I said, Canada. And he said, you coming back? I said, yes, I am coming back. he said, well, when you come back, just remember the speed limit here is 55 miles an hour. So when I got back to the office on Monday, the guys were absolutely furious about this. Heck, Ron, we would have been in prison for the weekend if we'd been driving at that speed. He let you off because you're a foreigner. Well, I thought that was okay. I thought this is just, you know, this is just good American, good manners and welcoming behavior. So I was very happy with it.
Well, Ron, we're down to our last question in this interview, and this is where I kind of turn the tables. And then, so what I'm asking you, Ron, is if you were conducting this interview, do you have any added questions that you would ask? And then what would be your answers?
Okay. I think I would want to ask something like, would you, if you had your life again, would you still go into IT? And I think the answer to the question is probably yes, providing I knew about it. Because I have to tell you that my original intention was to go into publishing. I was going to be an editor of technical books. But I was actually made redundant before I even started work because that part of the company closed down. And it was by chance that I met a friend of mine that was working in information technology, and I must say it sounded really, really interesting. I should add that most people in those days had no idea what a computer was, but I must say it's been extremely exciting. Huge changes taking place, change being more or less continuous, and I think if you're not into that kind of thing, probably be a good industry to keep away from. But it suited me very well. I like new things. I like change. And so I think, you know, if you'd asked me that question, I would say, yes, I'd go into IT again, providing I happened to meet an old friend in a pub who explained to me what a computer was, because if that hadn't happened, I would the opportunity would have passed me by.
Ron, considering your world leadership and this whole area of skills and capability and your leadership within the CIFIL organization, I know your schedule is very demanding. And we in the audience are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your many deep experiences and insights with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, because however busy you are, I do think it is really important to talk to people. You learn and they learn. And I think we should just go on talking to each other. So I'm really delighted to have had the opportunity. Thank you, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Ron McLaren, Operations Manager, CIFIL, International Top-Ranking Authority in Skills and Capability Management.